website for details, as well as our link to all the data from the eviction lab. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills. A very happy birthday to Joe Parker, a landmark birthday here. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 and 42 seconds on the dot. Coming up next is your Friday evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art in Portland. This concert is a collaboration of the Camas High School Choir, indie rock musician Kelly Pratt, and young audiences of Oregon and Southwest Washington. The concert is an original hour-long performance for a rock band, horns, and 200 high school singers, blending together a wide array of styles and genres. Again, that's Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art, 15 Northeast Hancock Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KBOO's history.
I came down to the Salmon Street Studios, where the federal courthouse is, the first official home of KBOO.
Came into this rather bizarre situation where we were in the basement of an attorney's office.
And at that meeting, he said, well, I'm just going to let you know that when your lease is up in about 18 months, we will not renew your lease. We will extend it for up to 6 months at double the rent.
When I was hired, they said, we want to be on the air by the end of July. And I went, whoa, how much money do we have to pull this off? And they said, you know, we got $11,000. How are we going to build this facility with $11,000?
To hear the stories of people who helped make KBOO what it is today, go to 50yearsofkboo.fm and click on KBOO Stories Project.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah has finally sold the Wapato Jail to a developer.
The president wants an aggressive strike in Syria, putting him at odds with his military advisors.
And we'll look at Me Too Literary Salon coming to Portland this weekend.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 13th, 2018. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin. Yesterday, the Multnomah County Board approved the sale of the Wapato Jail to private developer Marty Kehoe for $5 million. The project was initially approved by voters in 1996 in response to an uptick in arrests for drug and violent crime in the early and mid-1990s, itself partly a result of state mandatory minimum laws passed as part of Ballot Measure 11 in 1994. The jail was dedicated in July of 2004 and has mostly been empty ever since, according to the county's webpage explaining to voters where their money was spent. That money includes the initial $46 million county bond, $12 million in funds from the state, and $300,000 annually just to keep nature from claiming the building. The sheriff at the time of the jail's dedication, Bernie Giusto, admitted that because of property tax restrictions passed by voters not long after they had approved the jail, it would be too expensive for the county to operate it. In recent years, there's been a steady drumbeat of support for turning the jail into a temporary shelter. Commissioner Loretta Smith, who is running for Dan Salzman's seat on the Portland City Council, has long supported this plan and was the only vote against the sale of the shelter to Kehoe. The shelter idea has received considerable pushback from housing advocates and service providers who say the jail is too far from existing services and bus lines and could amount to, quote, warehousing, end quote, the homeless. Kehoe, the developer, who will soon own the jail, plans to use it as a medical instrument distribution center.
Today, the Office of Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum released a one-page info sheet explaining the state's so-called red flag law. Oregon is the fifth state to pass such a law, which puts legal proceedings in place to remove firearms and concealed carry licenses from people deemed a risk to others or themselves. The info sheet was released as part of National Crime Victims' Rights Week, a commemoration started by Ronald Reagan in 1981 and usually characterized by calls for increased law enforcement and harsher sentencing. The law allows people with a close relationship to a person of concern or a law enforcement officer to petition their local circuit court for an extreme risk protection order, or ERPO. The judge must hold a hearing, usually within 24 hours. An approved ERPO is then usually effective for at least a year. The person requesting the order must appear at the hearing either in person or by video. The subject of the order can request the hearing themselves within 21 days of an order. As Rosenblum says, the law is simple, but, quote, its effects could be significant.
Last weekend's shooting of John Elifritz by the Portland police once again demonstrated the Bureau's predisposition towards violence and the use of lethal force. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
Last weekend's police shooting at the City Team Ministries in southeast Portland would seem to confirm that the 2013 consent decree negotiated between the U.S. Department of Justice and the City of Portland meant nothing to the Portland Police Bureau. The settlement resulted from a 2012 DOJ finding that the Portland police engaged in a pattern of unconstitutional use of force against individuals with actual or perceived mental illness. And by all accounts, on Saturday, April 7th, John Andrew Elifritz was certainly exhibiting behavior that one would associate with a mental health crisis. At 2:25 p.m. that day, the 48-year-old married father of one evidently called 911 to report that his family had been murdered. When police responded to the address given, they discovered it was a construction site. The contractor told the police a man had been there acting strangely. Police confirmed that the family was safe, while a second group of officers found Elifritz at Southeast 86th and Holgate Avenue, where he held a knife to his own throat and then ran away. The police chose not to try to detain him. About 2 hours later, Elifritz apparently hijacked a car, and at about 7:30 that evening, that car was reported to have crashed near Southeast Martin Luther King and Stark Street, but by the time the police responded, the car was abandoned. Just before 8 p.m., Elifritz is reported to have burst into the City Team's dining hall and homeless shelter, where he is reported to have threatened residents before he began stabbing himself. A horrifying cell phone video shows what happened next when about 20 heavily armed police swarmed into the shelter. Brace yourself, this is painful to listen to. From the moment the first officer yells, "Drop the knife," until the shooting begins and a man's life ends is less than 15 seconds. The video clearly shows that Elifritz was contained in a small area that was well out of striking distance of either a resident or a cop, and he doesn't appear to even begin moving in the direction of the police until the shooting begins. The police make no apparent effort to de-escalate the situation, nor do they appear to have any interest in restraining the man through non-lethal means. In fact, the video makes it look like some of the officers simply chose to execute him. 8 officers opened fire, 7 from the Portland Police Bureau and 1 Multnomah County Sheriff's deputy. They are all now on paid administrative leave. And it will probably come as no surprise that at least 3 of the officers have a track record of violence. Andrew Polis was one of the officers who in 2010 shot Keaton Otis, a mentally ill black man, after Otis shot an officer in the leg. Polis and his colleagues fired 32 rounds. Bradley Nutting's policing tactics were called into question after he hit a man on a bicycle 6 times with a taser in 15 seconds in 2014, and Chad Pfeiffer was one of the officers actually cited for excessive use of force in the DOJ investigation of 2012. Mayor Wheeler and Chief Outlaw have called for patience and promised full transparency and an investigation into the police shooting, but I'm not optimistic. Elifritz was convicted and sent to prison for car theft in his 20s, and as recently as 10 years ago, he may have been a member of a white supremacist group, so he's not an especially sympathetic character. Still, whether sympathetic or not, no one deserves to be summarily executed by a trigger-happy police officer. The police behavior was best summed up in the shocked comments of witnesses that were captured on the cell phone video.
Oh my God.
Blew him away, dude.
Oh my God.
That's right. They blew him away. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Resist the is a new quarterly event that donates proceeds to nonprofits in Portland and the greater Northwest. KBOO's Zelos Marchand spoke with Audie and Tara, the producers of the show, to find out more.
I have in the studio Tara, organizer and producer, and Audie, also organizer and producer of Resist the Variety Show. And we're not resisting variety shows, but we're resisting other things, right?
That's true. You
all
got
right.
it.
Well, yeah. Thanks for coming to KBOO. Do you want to tell our listeners about Resist the Variety Show?
So Resist the Variety Show is an opportunity for artists and activists to come together and to do creative works of empowered resistance. We have, like the name implies, a variety of acts from music and dance to film, comedy, circus acts, and skill shares. So part of what we want to do is for these shows to actually teach people certain skills and tools that they can use for the resistance, as well as information and sharing our art.
Right yeah. on.
This month it's going to be at the Clinton Street Theater, which is on Southeast Clinton Street.
A historic and venue, I'm sure most of the audience is familiar
it was
with.
It's snazzy that they named it simply so people could find it.
Yeah, that's easy. Thanks for doing that. Shout out. It'll be Sunday, which is April 15th at 2 p.m. It's a matinee. We're sliding scale. It's $5 to $20, but nobody's turned away for lack of funds. And all of the profits are going to go to an organization called BARC, who defends Mount Hood National Forest from logging projects and destructive extractive activity. And so with that, our theme this month is going to be forests. So hopefully most of our acts are going to be forest-themed.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Artists are usually pretty sensitive about this stuff.
It will be at least vaguely.
Yes. Right. So I understand that each event, each variety show has a different nonprofit that the proceeds are going towards.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, that's right. So we partner with different groups. Previously, in our previous shows, we've worked with CLDC with
Signal Fire
and Don't Shoot Portland. So we always have a theme that fits in with the organization's work. Mm-hmm. And then all of the money we raised goes to those organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Awesome. So do you go do you seek out the nonprofits or do they come to you? I'm sure you're just probably crossing pathways and you're like, hey, do you want to collaborate? Doesn't look like that.
Yeah, those are all organizations that we know people who work with them. And so we've kind of already have a connection and mm-hmm. we already know them really well and want to support them. Mm-hmm. So far we have been reaching out to those orgs that we already have connections with and support.
Cool. So if you're an artist wanting to get involved in and resist the variety, what should an artist do?
We have an email that we use. It's just resistthevarietyshow@gmail.com. Pretty simple.
Straightforward.
Pretty straightforward.
And you can also search for us on Facebook.
Yeah.
Awesome. So how often does this happen?
Let's say quarterly. About every 3 months.
All right. Great. Will it always be at the Clinton Theater? Is it kind of rotate in different places just based on availability?
It's moved around a little bit. This will be our second time doing it at the Clinton Street Theater, and we've had a great experience of collaborating with them. Another shout out to the Clinton Street Theater.
Clinton Street!
But we have worked at other venues as well. We're interested in bringing it around to different neighborhoods and reaching different people.
And maybe in the summertime, we'll do like a park, outdoor setting.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe sometime it'll just be in the forest. Yeah, who knows what'll happen.
We just don't know.
We don't know.
That's awesome.
We like to keep it open and let it be sort of fluid and work with what we're doing.
That's great. Okay, so I've been speaking with Tara and Audie, organizers and producers of Resist the Variety Show. And do you want to tell our listeners one more time who are just tuning in?
All right, that'll be at the Clinton Street on Sunday, which is the 15th at 2 p.m. Yeah, our theme is forest. We're representing Bark this time.
And you can get tickets by going to the Clinton Street Theater website. You are also welcome to just show up and pay at the door.
Awesome. Easy. Easy peasy.
It's so easy. It's too easy.
It's almost unbelievable.
It's unbelievably easy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on KBOO.
Thank you so much.
This is Zello Zellos Marchant for KBOO News. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin from the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses, featuring a discussion with writer Cinda Stevens Lonsway, author of I Now Know, her story of overcoming trauma and its long-term effects. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will see a low of 48 with 60% chance of rain. Today in history, April 13th, saw the bloodiest event of the Reconstruction era when upwards of 150 black people were killed by a white supremacist terrorist in Colfax, Louisiana. The prosecutions of some white perpetrators by the federal government were overturned in the Supreme Court case U.S. v. Cruikshank, which severely weakened the power of the federal government to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments. The quote of the day is from W.E.B. Du Bois, activist, sociologist, and co-founder of the NAACP, writing about the end of Reconstruction decades later. Quote, "It was property and privilege shrieking to its own kind, and privilege and property heard and recognized the voice of its own," end quote.
Kara Cruikshank began working on interdisciplinary events involving professional artists, amateur artists, philosophers, intellectuals, teachers, and people from a myriad of other experiences to help form Café de la Culture. Its mission is to find what humans have in common under the broad topic of feminism. She is bringing a hashtag MeToo literary salon to Portland this Sunday, April 15th. KBOO Zellos Marchant spoke with Kara to find out more.
I have in the studio Kara Cruikshank, the producer and creator of the Café de la Culture community, and there's a really great upcoming event, the first one from your collective of sorts called the Courageous Vulnerability Me Too Tour. Thank you so much for stopping through in the middle of your jet setting to come to Portland and talk to KBOO about this event.
My pleasure.
What is Café de la Culture?
Café de la Culture is a production company that I created, which creates conversations and artistic performances to promote diversity, women's voices, and social change.
That's cool. Well, not to deviate too far from you the subject. Great. So the Courageous Vulnerability Me Too Tour... I mean, I'm sure obviously the Me Too movement inspired that, but tell us more about the event. And
yeah, this event actually launched a year ago. Okay. Out of Paris, I recently wrote a show called The Alchemy of Imperfection. Mm-hmm. And that is a piece that I've been working on for quite a few years, which explores female experiences that transcend cultural boundaries. And it's also a look at the phases of being a woman in each process of being young, being middle-aged, being elder, and what echoes across generations in female experience as well as across culture. So I launched the show last year in Paris as a workshop to, you know, put it before new audiences, and then I brought it to Boulder and LA. So each city that I bring it to, I cast local actors, often, you know, a compilation of professional and amateur actors. And so it's a different cast every time, and it's a different group of women of different ethnicities every time and different ages. So it's never the same. It's a scripted show, but it's never the same show twice, in that whatever the cultural context that's brought to these characters can shape the piece. And so since doing that project, I've been working on that ongoing, and you know, then suddenly Trump was elected, started talking about grabbing women's pussies, and you know, the Women's March happened, and feminist and feminism became the most Google searched word in the dictionary or on Wikipedia for 2017, and the Me Too movement, you know, sprung out of Hollywood, or the new incarnation of it. And so all of these things have happened sort of as I've been preparing this project to launch on a bigger level. So the time is interesting.
Do you want to give our listeners who will just be tuning in the where, the what, the how, sure, the how much, and all that stuff?
Yeah, it's taking place at Tabor Space in I guess near Mount Tabor. I'm still learning the neighborhoods.
It's a volcanic hill, actually, that we call a mountain.
Okay. I haven't hiked it yet, but I'm hoping to. And that'll take place this Sunday, April 15th at 6 p.m. Doors open to the public at 5:30, and there's tier ticketing online at cafedelaculture.com. This is also a fundraising event to do more of these conversations in more communities.
Reuters reports today that President Trump is asking the military to consider striking aggressively against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his allies Russia and Iran in Syria. This comes as Trump, with or without his advisors, is making a show of his horror at the use of chemical weapons by Assad against opposition forces, and is increasingly critical of Russia for its failure to prevent such attacks. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis cautioned against a more aggressive approach, echoing other observers who say that it risks a wider war between superpowers in the region. In anxious times such as these, it helps to collect one's thoughts and observations. KABU volunteer Teresa Mitchell has these thoughts to offer.
If one examines the claims of poison gas being used in Syria rather than watching the ubiquitous video, it quickly becomes clear that there is no clarity. There is a UN Commission of Inquiry, and the only word from them on the issue so far, given that they have not had time to enter the war zone hospital in question, is the opinion expressed on an Italian television interview and repeated in the Atlantic magazine in the U.S. that it is likely that anti-Assad rebels have used poison gas. Here is the translated quote. Our investigators have been in neighboring countries interviewing victims, doctors, and field hospitals, and according to their report of last week, which I have seen, there are strong concrete suspicions but not yet incontrovertible proof of the use of sarin gas from the way the victims were treated. This was use on the part of the opposition, the rebels, not by the government authorities, end quote. That's according to Carla Del Ponte, a member of the UN Commission. And as Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung pointed out earlier this week, it is not logically nor morally consistent to proceed to retaliatory military strikes at this point merely on the declarations of U.S. leaders, since we all hopefully recall that when then Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the United Nations on the accusation of poison gas, biological warfare, and nuclear weapons in Iraq, he was quite forceful and certain in his delivery. The relevant quote from February 5, 2003 is, "There can be no doubt that Saddam Hussein has biological weapons and the capability to rapidly produce many, many more," end quote. Powell also stated that there was, quote, no doubt in my mind, end quote, that Saddam was working to obtain key components to produce nuclear weapons. And if you remember that, maybe you will also remember that it was a lie and that a million people have perished from bombs, bullets, and the aftermath since. It's interesting to note that during that famous lying UN speech, John Bolton was ambassador to the UN under the Bush administration, and he vigorously promoted Saddam's use of poison gas as a casus belli. Is it a coincidence that the new accusations appear on the day he arrived at the Trump White House? Right now, the biggest armada since that speech is heading towards Syria, including destroyers and submarines with around 400 Tomahawk missiles. The aircraft carrier USS Truman, which carried F-18 fighter bombers, is underway, accompanied by 7 heavily armed escort ships and at least 1 submarine. That force will be joined by B-1B bombers, F-22 stealth fighters, and at least 10,000 troops in Qatar. That's not to mention the 5th Fleet in Bahrain. Meanwhile, the Russian Navy has launched live-fire exercises off the Syrian coast. They intend to keep that up at least until the 26th of this month to show that they do not intend to allow an uncontested bombing campaign. Iran and Russia are poised for war, as is Israel on the other side. Most of the ships will not arrive in the region for another week. Perhaps it is time to remind our elected leaders that we don't stand for imperial adventures, nor do we feel like risking nuclear obliteration for the sake of obfuscating President Trump's legal difficulties. Speaking for myself, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
And now it's time for today's report from National and Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal librarians were among those advocating in Washington, D.C. this week for legislation to close the digital divide in rural tribal communities. The event Thursday was organized by New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich, who touts a tribal program in his state as a possible model for tribes elsewhere. Cynthia Aguilar is a librarian for New Mexico's Santo Domingo Pueblo. She said the current limited broadband makes it hard for Pueblo residents and employees to accomplish simple tasks related to education or economic opportunities.
If we have a grant that needs to be submitted, we started at 2 in the afternoon, and by 5, it's still spinning and spinning and spinning, and then we leave for the night, we leave it on, we come back, and it's still doing the same thing. And so those grant opportunities go by the wayside because we missed our deadline.
Santo Domingo partnered with the neighboring San Felipe, Cochiti, and Santa Ana Pueblos to combine their demand for better internet. That's how they were able to get nearly $4 million from E-Rate, a decades-old federal program, to start building broadband network. Senator Heinrich hopes to better utilize that program to be more equitable for tribes throughout the U.S.
Although over 90% of public libraries throughout the nation as a whole have received these FCC funds through the program to support improved internet access, the National Congress of American Indians estimates that only 15% of tribal libraries have received any of this critical funding. That is a huge disparity.
Heinrich, a Democrat, and Dean Heller, a Republican senator from Nevada, are both pushing the bill that would help tribes access E-rate funds. Senator Tina Smith, a Democrat from Minnesota, said this week she also plans to introduce legislation to support rural and tribal broadband projects by tapping into USDA funding. The California Coastal Commission held its first public hearing this week on what tribal members called a long overdue policy to consult Native American tribes on coastal planning matters. Among the tribal members who spoke Wednesday was Maura Sullivan, testifying on behalf of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation.
As Chumash people, we have some of the most expensive and sought-after coastline, but it is our heritage and territory, and we don't use it just for fishing and gathering, but also for prayer. The ocean is our first mother. That is why this tribal consultation policy is so important. As a Chumash woman, I feel acknowledged. I feel seen in a world that has tried to invisibilize us.
California has 109 federally recognized and 55 state recognized tribes. The Coastal Commission was supposed to develop their tribal consultation policy after a governor's order in 2011. It's expected to formally adopt the policy this summer. The Gila River Indian community is remembering prominent tribal attorney and legal scholar Rodney Lewis this week. AZ Central reports Lewis died Tuesday at the age of 77. He's known for negotiating a legal victory for the Gila River community in 2004 as part of the largest tribal water settlement in U.S. history. The Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians will consider regulating the use of culturally important words for commercial purposes. The Smoky Mountain News reports that decision comes after a heated debate over names used by the Seven Clans Brewery, started by two Eastern Cherokee women. Tribal members who oppose the brewery's naming choices say it's offensive to tie culturally important symbols to alcohol, a substance with a harmful and controversial legacy in Cherokee society. The brewery owners argue that idea is outdated and say they only meant to honor their culture. As Seven Clans Brewery is a private business, not on tribal land, it's unclear what effect future regulations could have on its operation. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Teresa Mitchell. Special thanks to Eric Takeoff with the Oregon News Service. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. And the KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zella Celis-Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Thank you for listening and have a great evening. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Ruben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.